25% of cars sold in South Africa are imported vehicles, and that is growing, and we can see very shortly that can hit 70%. We've also indicated in the second point up there that the marks that are imported are predominantly the vehicles that we've indicated on the slide. The other issue which we have to make is that a number of the component suppliers in South Africa are also foreign owned, and there are only a few now that are locally owned suppliers. And that's an important point to make. So you can see there's a lot of foreign influence on the South African motor industry. However, then the majority upstream suppliers, which we call two-tier and two-three suppliers, are predominantly locally owned, and these tend to be smaller companies and concerns. Just in terms of the motor industry employment, you can see it is very significant. I mentioned at the last presentation that we've lost about 20,000 jobs in the last 12 months, mainly due to the recession. But you can still see our total employment is 297,000. Now, on top of that, if we have a look at the RMI, which is the aftermarket organization, they estimate there's another 100,000 people employed in the less formal sector who are not members of the RMI. So in actual fact, you can see we've got about 400,000 people employed in this industry. If we lost the OEM industry, you would probably still have the motor trade and servicing, which is about 300,000. But you can see the total manufacturing is around 100,000 people employed in the assembly business, the assembly plants and the component industry. Now, the projections on the right-hand side in 2020, that's the projections made by Justin Barnes, who was one of the consultants in the APDP plan. And he estimates that if we do build 1.1 million vehicles by 2020, we could be employing 176,000 people in the direct assembly of automobiles. So you can see it's not an insignificant employer of South Africans. Now, we were also asked at the last meeting, what has happened in the industry, and there's no doubt that there's been a significant improvement in quality and productivity over the last 10 years or so. And we've also had a rationalization. The MIDP has been a very successful program. Another question that was posed to us, I think the only unforeseen circumstances of the MIDP has been the level of imported vehicles, which has taken everybody by surprise. With the local platforms, the rationalization has happened. It's gone down from 42 in the middle 90s to 18 today. And the average model volume per model has also increased from 9,000 units to 29,000. A very important aspect, because in manufacturing, economies of scale, particularly in the component industry, are critical. One of our biggest disadvantages as a South African component manufacturer is our low economies of scale. So at the moment, you can see the second and third point there. Three models are greater than 40,000. Nine models are greater than 20,000, and we've got one model currently, which is Toyota, which is greater than 100,000, and very shortly you'll have another Volkswagen model that will be selling greater than 100,000. When I say selling, rather building, because to us in the component industry, it's not the cars sold that's important, it's the cars produced in this country. Okay, we've also seen the productivity that's gone up from 10 vehicles per annum to 15.5 vehicles per annum. So we've had a 55% productivity improvement over the same period. So although this industry gets a lot of criticism, I still think we've made giant strides in improving our quality and productivity. Just moving on, we're looking at the affordability of vehicles. And certainly, due to probably competitive forces and to some extent imported vehicles, the new vehicle prices have been predominantly below inflation for the last 14 years. We've also had exceptional growth in vehicle industry exports, not only in vehicles but also in components. Our problem has been that in the last 2 years we've had a massive drop in both local sales and exports, particularly in 2009, where the number of vehicles produced reduced by about 34%. We probably had the worst performing motor industry in the world last year. One of the reasons for that was that most other countries had incentives to encourage purchasing, you know, bangers for cash and other incentives. South Africa chose not to have any incentives, so we had a real dive in our automotive industry. Employment has been relatively stable. It was only last year where we lost 29,000, and I think the previous graph that I showed that we were a net employer of net gain in employment over the 10 years, and it was just the last 18 months we lost a significant proportion of employees, predominantly in the component sector. And then the trade deficit also narrowed substantially during 2008 and 2009, and that was mainly because of the export program in terms of both automobiles and in terms of components. The concern, however, is the level of imported vehicles at the moment, and of course that doesn't help the trade deficit. This is just a graph which shows the improvement in quality, another question that was raised, I think, at the last meeting. And this is quality in motor vehicles is measured in parts per million, PPMs, and the higher the PPM, of course, the lower the quality. So you can see the significant improvement in quality from 1998 to 2008, and that is a huge magnitude of improvement. And South African motor vehicles today, I think, can compare with anywhere in the world. In fact, in some areas, in many areas, South African produced car is superior to anything produced in Europe, because unfortunately there's a perception in the world that anything that comes from the third world is inferior. So what you tend to find is the inspection of our vehicles is far more stringent than vehicles that are coming out of Europe. Import duties in the MIDP, I think that was a question raised last time. And although there are nominal duties of 27% on vehicles and 22% on components, in actual fact, both come in virtually duty-free because of the rebated MIDP, which I think Theo explained to you at the last meeting, how the rebated duty works. There's also a duty-free allowance of 27% for vehicle assemblers. They can import components 27% duty-free. And plus, with the rebate they get from the MIDP, they basically are not paying duties at all. So you'll find that the component industry is under a lot of pressure because, A, there's no duty protection for them, and really they need that because of the economies of scale, and secondly, the current strong exchange rate. And more recently, it was just the dollar that was weak, but now we're finding the euro weak as well, is placing a lot of pressure on benchmark pricing, and that is squeezing the component industry's margin. So you can see at the very bottom point there, we said the OEMs are virtually paying zero duty on components. And now we're looking at auto exports to South Africa, how important they are, and I think that graph shows it very aptly on how the South African motor industry has improved our export performance over the last 30 years or so. And I think what is really interesting to note is the percentage of a percentage that automotive exports make is a total percentage of South African exports, which is 15%, up from 4.1% in 1995. I've already talked about the major exports, and I think you're all very aware, but Volkswagen, BMW, Mercedes and Toyota are our major export OEMs, and I think they're soon to be joined by Ford, who have a major export program which will commence in the next 2 years. Now, the breakdown of local content, we believe it is It's about 36% of a car, as cars components are localized. And really, our organization would encourage the OEMs to push this up to 75. And I said last time in my presentation that to us the model is Thailand that has in excess of 90% local content. We can show the components of the motor vehicle, and in red you can see the true local material plus added value of a South African component in a car in those particular categories of components.
I would just like to emphasize that the reason why we included this graph was the question of how deep does the component industry goes into the economy. If you look at the commodities provided here, it goes deep into the plastics, the steels, the cast iron business. So if we lose this industry, there's a big portion of our commodity trade that will be affected through the vehicle. So we've broken it down in those commodities. So the committee can identify against IPAC what is the important ones that have trade deficits and needs to be addressed.
Okay, now we're looking at the challenges in expanding and deepening local content, and I think in all those product categories we actually detail some of the challenges that face us, and most of them it's low volumes, economies of scale, technology, and distance from design centers offshore, because cars today are designed in their source countries, and so you'll find suppliers in those countries also have significant advantage in dealing with procurement departments of host OEMs. And you can go through that at in your leisure and see where see the reasons why the challenges are faced the South African component industry. Now, just in terms of putting South Africa in perspective, unfortunately we're a very small fish in this big pond, and we build actually less than 1% of the world's automobiles. And so it makes you feel very humble when you look at that. And yet we do have a vibrant industry which is absolutely essential to the economy of South Africa. Okay, other challenges and opportunities, and I'm nearing the end now, increasing economies of scale, as I said before, very, very important for South Africa. And the component manufacturers. If you just have a look at, if you look at even supplying Toyota here, that will build 100,000 in one vehicle. Our competitors in Japan and Europe will be building 600,000 of the same vehicle. So you can imagine as a component supplier, you're competing with massive economies of scale offshore. And as we go down the food chain and looking at supplying vehicles that do say 25,000 to 30,000, in Europe, our competitors are supplying into bills there of around 500,000 to 600,000. So it is really a huge disadvantage for South Africans in terms of competing. It's also one of the main reasons where the component industry continually gets embraced by everybody that's not competitive, and this is one of the main reasons why we battle to compete. And so we do need some compensation to make up for the economies of scale. New technology, that is important to us because the automobile today is becoming increasingly sophisticated. And I think also, and we mentioned that last time, the importance then of choosing which vehicles to be made in South Africa is also important, because if you continue to look at very sophisticated motor cars with low volumes, it's very difficult for South African suppliers to compete. So you're now looking at an area where the OEMs are building, as they're doing in Thailand, light commercials and maybe more simple cars than what they build in other parts of the world. Excess capacity of many global suppliers, another problem to us. If you could have a look at last year where the recession hit the world, we found that many of the OEMs in South Africa went back to overseas suppliers because the European or the American parents had surplus stock, and then they would just turn off the tap to the suppliers. We just don't have the influence that some of our competitors do overseas. Supply development capabilities of local organizations, again, we don't have the infrastructure, and the investment, and again the economies of scale to cope with development. So we depend on technical agreements with overseas component suppliers. And I think we've been very effective in forging these relationships. Suppliers controlled from offshore, I've discussed that before. It's now very difficult for us because virtually all the procurement departments don't report to South African management anymore. They report to their parents offshore. And therefore, overseas suppliers can forge much closer relationships with procurement offices offshore than we can in South Africa. And it is something which we have to work on. Strong currency has two negative effects, as I mentioned before. It encourages imports, it pushes down benchmark pricing, and therefore shrinks our margins, and you can't run a business on very low margins, and of course it's restricting our exports. Our big concern at the moment is the move in the euro, because a lot of our exports go to European countries, and whereas last year we had a relatively strong euro, this year we're facing a situation where the euro is weak and it's put extra pressure on our industry. Increased electricity costs, considerable for some component suppliers. Those that run forges and furnaces, we've had significant increases from the Eskom tariff, and we're looking ahead to two more years of significant cost increases. The opportunities, and I think there are a number. The first one is we need to bring in some new suppliers into the South African market. But more importantly, we would like those new suppliers to JV with the South African suppliers and work together, not work against them and put them out of business. And this is a move which we're working on with the OEMs to encourage investment and tie up with South African companies. We've got a supplier development initiative with UNIDO from the United Nations, AIDC, and NARCAM with the support of the DTI. And we're hoping that's going to assist us in our competitiveness. So we've got a number of other proposals which we want to put to government through the DTI. You know, we have got the APDP, which we're looking forward to, but unfortunately that's only in 2 years. And we also believe that to get the South African component industry up and running, we need more supplier-specific incentives. And I think to some extent that is catered for in IPAP too, and you know, we hope to move that forward. One of our big disadvantages in South Africa as exporters is the bench, the port charges. I know both ourselves and NAMSA, the Automotive Association, has made this presentation in many forums in South Africa. But I think we have the second most expensive port charges in the world, second only to the United States. And that is a big negative for us in terms of our exports. The Thailand example, which we mentioned last time, and we were asked to give some details on, I think you can see that there is significant duty protection in Thailand, where the local industry is protected. And also interesting, Thailand went and focused on building pickups, or as we know them as buggies, and been very successful in growing that industry. And possibly that's the way South Africa needs to move, where the incentives are focused more at cars that can increase their local content, i.e., as we mentioned last time, low-entry vehicles into this market, because at the moment most of the low-entry vehicles are imported. With light commercials, we've got a good coverage of that area, and then of course people movers, which Theo mentioned last time, we should be encouraging South Africa to build, say, the Quantum here, rather than some of the other passenger cars. So I think that will need a change in thinking. It's going to be difficult because obviously you have to dictate to the OEMs, but that's one way you can increase the local content, and it certainly was a very successful program in Thailand. They have significant investment incentives in Thailand. But what they, but no specific export incentives, so it is WTO friendly. But what they do is that the Thai government works with each OEM and with each component supplier and details a specific tailored program to their requirements. Now, the other thing that's incredibly impressive in Thailand is that the Thai government and the Japanese government and the German government set up these training schools, these technical colleges to train auto technicians. And they work very well, and they've increased the skill base significantly with the help of Japan and Germany. This is a thorny subject, but it's absolutely relevant. His wages and salary rates in Thailand are 64% below South African averages, and only 11.7% of total component cost. In South Africa, wages and salaries make up over 20% of our cost base. And then, of course, overhead costs are also lower than South Africa. Electricity is lower than South Africa as well. Not too much lower, but it is slightly lower. So those are the main reasons why the Thailand example works, and certainly I think it's worth us studying further. Right, silver bullets. We obviously are looking at increasing the models per or numbers per model. And certainly the APDP is defining a target of 50,000 vehicles per annum per model. And obviously the closer you move to 100,000, the more it helps the component industry. We need to move the component industry from less than 40% to 70%. We do have to improve our supplier competitiveness in a number of ways. I think a lot of that has already happened, but unfortunately, because of the stresses and strains forced on the industry by OEMs and also the exchange rate and benchmarking, we've had a number of our companies have gone out of business over the last 2 years. Manufacturing depth, that's really saying that we need to increase the Tier 2 and Tier 3 suppliers. That, I think, also is very aligned with the IPAP document, looking at encouraging small and medium-sized businesses. And I think if there is that incentive to encourage and nurture small business, it is very welcomed. And if we have a look at IPAP, APDP, and the IDC, there's a lot of alignment and synergy in the words, and now we have to make it work. Productivity is very important. With economies of scale that we have, we're going to have to drive productivity, and I think here we need a new order of agreement between business and our organized labor. And probably business has to take the lead here, but I believe that our industrial relations in South Africa is probably 30 years behind the time. And we're still very much stuck into the industrial relations of the 70s. We need to change that. We need massive investment in training and skills, and I think there we certainly can take a leaf out of the Thailand book. And I think we could get a lot of assistance from the Germans and the Japanese and set up these schools as they have done in Thailand. Skilled immigration program, I believe passionately in that. We're not going to get our skills levels up in the next 2 to 3 years unless we go on a really honed and aggressive immigration program. It's not going to be negative for employment in South Africa, it's going to be the reverse, because if we can get a lot of skilled immigrants, they'll pass on their skills and they themselves will create employment. And then competitive currency, I've mentioned that many times. Now there was a question last time too about what is driving the rand. And as we said, it very much follows the movement of the JSE, and the JSE follows the movement in raw material demand and prices. So you can see this positive correlation between falling rand, falling JSE prices, and also falling mineral prices. So we have a situation where the motor industry, or maybe manufacturing industry, is trapped in this rand model. Movements in the rand have no bearing at all on the economic fundamentals that are driving manufacturing in this country. Okay, I think I've answered most of the questions. Please, any questions for Theo and myself? Madam Chairman, we'll be pleased to answer.
I think we've made up some very good time. Thank you very much. I must say it's very exciting and informative submission. Any questions, comments on the left? Honourable Turok, Honourable Marais, Honourable Khabebe.
I'm sorry I was ill when you came last time, so I hope I'm not repeating things you've dealt with. But 2 points. Firstly, clearly, economies of scale depend on your export performance, not on the domestic market. And therefore, it's really, you know, we're told globalization is a wonderful opportunity. It's also a threat, as far as what your presentation shows. And there's no easy answer, as you know, but that is the essence of your problem. But the point I really wanted to address is this, that in South Korea, the government supported the motor industry for 5 years, which was loss-making, and now it's a world champion. Have we done comparatively the same here in the MIDP? How would you classify it in comparative terms to what Japan has done, South Korea, etc.? But the key of what China has done is as they borrow foreign industry from Japan, for example, they always ensure that the R&D component eventually comes with it. Because practically, motor vehicle and all assembly plants in all industries is actually a very peripheral activity. When you assemble other people's components, you're really not building much of your own. And the heart of it all is that as you assemble, you also steal the R&D from the parent company. That's the heart of it all. And if South Africa is going to industrialize, we can't concentrate solely on components and the stuff that you're talking about. We've got to say a long-term view requires that we develop the R&D capability, the design capability. And it seems to me, I'm sorry I missed your previous presentation, but that's the heart of the future of South African industrialization. I wonder if you can comment on that.
Thank you, Honorable Turek. Honorable Murray.
Thank you very much for this presentation. Actually, brought more questions to me, and it's actually a pity that there's not a lot longer time available. Because in terms of your presentation, I asked myself, and just to add on, or maybe to link to what Honorable Turok has said, is that this motor industry, if you must break it down, you've indicated that we, you know, assembly versus production. Because, you know, if you import 70% content of the motor vehicle production or the assembly of that vehicle, then, you know, it actually doesn't help us a lot. So what is the core of this industry? Do we want to assemble vehicles, or do we want to sell vehicles, or do we want to also manufacture components? I've got the feeling that we are not quite sure what is our core business. If we are not even 1% of the world market of vehicle manufacturers, is that what we need to be in, seeing that the others has got all these scale of economy benefits? Is that what we need to be in, or do we need to find a niche market? For instance, component manufacturing and export. How much of the impact that you've given us, also the forecast that you've given us, is due to pure assembly of vehicles, or how much is in the downstream, if I can call it that? Because for me, I want to try to get into my mind, what do we need to focus on? Because the other side of the coin is that if you can assemble components for exports, in other words, scale of economy, huge emphasis on that to supply Nissan and Toyota and BMW, whoever overseas, compared to the small portion that we are handling at the moment. And also in maintenance, because I've heard the argument that maybe we must do away with import duties on new vehicles totally, make it more affordable for the consumer to buy a vehicle. There will be a lot more on the road. The maintenance, the aftercare, the reparations might be a lot higher. That's probably devil's advocate by that specific person. So I want to get your comment on that. And then in terms of the efficiency that you were talking about on that one slide where you said substantial number of vehicles produced per employee for less than 10 vehicles per annum to 15.5, how much of that will be due to really the high efficiency of the labor, or how much of that will be due to higher production due to automation or high-tech machinery and equipment? So in other words, what is the impact of that on employment? Because all the benefits that you've given, one must obviously offset against the cost of promoting and supporting this industry. And we know it's billions of rand that the government is making available for this industry, and what is actually getting, what is the return of that? And a lot of these things are fantastic, and I'm asking myself my question, are we on a sidetrack that we should not be, or are we on this road where the light in front is the end of the tunnel, not a train coming towards us? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. I'll start with the fact that the presentation is very good. It's actually improved from what we had last week. And then, but what I'd like to highlight here is the issue of the human resource. I can see that what they want is that the productivity must improve from less than 20 cars per annum per employee to more than 30 cars per annum per employee. So in order for that high productivity to take place, it means that the skills level of the employees must be high. That one is the critical aspect. You can see that, as you acknowledge, that in Thailand and Japan, the government has put money aside for training of the employees. I think that also on our side, we put money aside for training of the employees. So I think what is critical here is to harness that money so that it goes to where it's supposed to go to. But what is worrying me is the issue when you compare Thailand and South Africa with respect to the wage. You say that in Thailand the wage gap is 64% less than what we're having here. But I think that in South Africa, we come from a bitter past, it's a fact. That in the past, the employees were exploited. They were exploited. Even when you go to the farms, they continue to be exploited. So the question I'd like to ask is, in this industry, what is the difference between the highest paid worker, that is the CEO and the floor, and the shop floor worker? Because if there's that high difference, I don't think that the unions are going to have a bite in there. What is the industry doing to narrow the gap? And then number two, when coming to the issue of the issue of 64% and then that one is 11.6%. The cost of doing business in the labor cost in Thailand is about 11.7%. In South Africa is around 20%. So I think that one also goes to the issue of the efficiency. What type of shift do we have? How much? What type of shift do we have? Because you can find that if you turn around, if you have done operations management, when you deal with the issue of shifts, then the way you allocate your shifts, you can have them to be optimal or you can have them not to be optimal. For example, in Germany, the factories, they work around the clock. Around in the morning, others get in, the others, but the weekly is done. What part of that? That inefficient is not part of the assignment of the work skills or at the factory place. Thank you, Chair.
Yes. Did I see another hand? No. Just a couple of points. You have pointed to the Thailand example on several occasions now. A couple of the points that you've noted here yourself, which do alarm me somewhat. You state here that wages and salary rates are 64% below the average in South Africa. I just wondered how you were hoping we were going to address that one. The other point again is on the slide referring to the manufacturing by country. You have on occasions pointed to Thailand. I'm not sure exactly where it sits here per se, but then also Australia was referred to in your previous submission. It would be interesting to see where some of these countries are sitting in relation to their production. The other one, which perhaps may be too soon to get from yourself, you have a slide on the auto exports. And of course, perhaps we're still awaiting that information for 2009 itself. Just one or two on the local input, which I think the Honourable Maria also pointed to, and Turok. When you do make references to the local input here, but I didn't actually hear you telling us, and perhaps that question has already been put to you, what suggestions have you got as to how this can be addressed? You're making the statement, but what can we do about increasing the local input itself? And the last point is, you made right at the beginning of the submission, you referred to the motor industry employment and indicated this was for the formal sector, broadly speaking, and it did not actually include what you described as the less formal. Now, I'm not sure what the less formal is. Is this the backyard issue or what? Thank you. That's over to the two of you there. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we can start on the Chinese model, I think one of the things that we trying to advocate is that up front, when motor companies negotiate new launches of vehicles with government from an incentive base, then we must just understand this incentive base is not fiscal incentive that it comes from taxable monies. It's a duty pool that's used, a duty rebate pool that's used in the process. The lesson learned from China is that any new entrant into the market is forced to a 50% local ownership. So one of the issues that's contrary to us in the Chinese model is that Chinese government require new entrants to partner up with local partners. So your question about the R&D, unfortunately R&D should lie in a country where there's significant vehicle demand. You do not develop for somebody that's got a declining demand. If you look at the latest Chinese sales figures, last year almost 14 million vehicles were sold into China, 40% more than were sold in America, who sold 10 million vehicles. So part of the partnership initiative is that new launch vehicles, especially entry-level vehicles, are done in partnership, 50% shareholding by a local company, and it comes with the crossover of the design. A portion of the design is done in that country. So that's the answer on the Chinese model. If I can then just answer the question about the value of the employment and the value of the export, there's no doubt that if you look at 1995, we were a gold country and we've exceeded the gold exports from South Africa with vehicle sales. That's come from the Motor Industry Development Program and the incentive that we had on the Motor Industry Development Program. The benefit that has brought to the country, that it has brought component manufacturing industry into South Africa. We have slipped on local content, and the only reason we have slipped on the local content is because it's not a prerequisite when a new vehicle is launched and government puts its stamp on approval on what is the targeted local content. Although the unofficial aim is to have 70% local content, it's not monitored on a continuous basis, and there's no insurance in it. And I think that's the issue that we raised in the previous meeting, is that we would like to ask government to look at building in assurance in it, that it's monitored on a quarterly basis, that upfront a BMW or a Toyota or Mercedes-Benz nominate the suppliers, that they nominate the joint venture partners or local supplier companies, that they put the local content on the table that forces our steel and our plastics and our rubber and our glass into that vehicle, and that it's monitored on a continuous basis, that we don't have these swings. Because unfortunately, Madam Chair, one of the questions that was correct, if you just look at the employment figures on our employment cycle, in the height, you do not see a huge amount of employment movement from 2005 to 2008, when the height of the vehicles was produced. in the vehicle assembly sector. The vehicle assembly sector only went from 34,000 employees to about 36,000. But in the component industry, you can see it went the other way around. And the question is, where's the focus? A lot of the niche in South Africa lies with our precious metals, the catalytic converter industry. South Africa, with the catalytic converters, the PMG metal groups, have developed a niche market where almost 20 to 30% of the world catalytic converters are produced in South Africa. And what we didn't split up for you is the split between vehicle exports and component exports. It's not just only vehicle exports, it's the component exports as well. And what we leverage on South Africa is our raw materials. We've got the copper, we've got the aluminium, we've got the steel, we've got the precious metals. Those products all go into vehicles. And that's where our component manufacturers. So for this committee to understand it better, we will send an additional graph that shows the split between the vehicle exports and then the component exports. And that's where the strength has gone. And the employment is lying in the component industry. And that industry, we cannot afford to lose that industry. Then the issue of wage competitiveness and what is industry doing to erode it. I must just say that as NARCAM as a body, and even my company itself, we've made a conscious decision that we will erode the wage gap. In the past 2 years, I think if you look at what was salary increases versus wage increases, there was a big differential. Some companies had no salary increases in the past year because of the pressure that was the industry. But because of our bargaining council that we belong to, we still had our 7.5% wage increases. But as an industry, made a conscious decision that no matter how small the differential, our own company target is about 50%. And what we're saying, if a wage increase is at 7.5% or 8%, then salary increases can't be more than 3 or 4. And if everybody in South Africa takes that view over a 300-year period, eventually we'll arrive the gap. But you've got to do it. There is no alternative but to do it. So the efficiency issues that we're addressing cannot be through wage cost alone. I think there's some structural issues that make our people poor. And I want to re-emphasize it. People that work for us spend more than 30% of their money coming to work. We say Thailand, they are 64% of our wage, but they spend no money coming to work. The government gets them to work. They get them into the industrial areas. They live in hostels and government accommodation close to the industrial areas that makes their cost of living and cost of traveling a fraction of what South Africa needs to do. So that's a structural issue that we need to address. And it's again our plea. If you look at the taxi recapitalization program, we lost a huge opportunity. We're producing a very, very, not at safe at the time, passenger carrier, but we're focused on quality and safety issues. We could have still been today been producing a minibus in South Africa, but we didn't. And maybe sometimes we must ask ourselves, what do we need to do in South Africa? Do we need to develop a new electric car, or do we need to develop a passenger carrier, or rather develop the passenger carrier? So it's a passionate issue. The industry has consciously decided to erase that gap. And I know it's not going to address it in 1 year, but we've got to take a 300-year view in this regard. And Madam Chair, then there's some of the questions that you have asked. What you would like to do is on those questions is just redivide our breakdown of the exports, what is the component exports into that. And just in your questions, maybe we must show you the whole vehicle manufacturing in the world. We showed you 75%. The other 25% obviously includes countries like Australia and Thailand. Thailand is about 1.2 to 1.3 million. They fall in that category, but it's mostly into the light commercial vehicles. So they've decided on a specific niche. But yes, South Africa can and must leverage from our commodity base. The commodities are here to produce a vehicle. We must spend more time on the beneficiation side, like developing the steels. If you take an ArcelorMittal, the industry has been fighting them for years to develop local, acceptable grade automotive steels. Why should we import? So part of IPAP is the minimal technology. that's spoken about. If ArcelorMittal will invest in a minimal facility for hot dip galvanizing facility, we can exclude 30% of the current steel that's imported on the automotive industry. Yes, so a specific focus on specific niches, we must leverage of our raw material availability. Just on the informal sector, the RMI numbers is only for affiliated bodies. So the small spare shop that sells the spares and the motor vehicle repairs and panel beating shops, that's not part of the association. In that industry, there's about 100,000 employees. So we say totally, we close on between 450 to 500,000 people employed in the automotive industry.
Yes, that's also quite significant. And clearly they're not on the side of the road. As you say, they are small or many establishments that exist. Members, we're just looking at a situation of 2:45. We have had a commitment by NARCAN to Mr. Jennings and Mr. Look to actually come back to us or to send to us, email to us, further material in response to some of the questions raised. So I think at this particular point in time, we would like to thank you for coming back to us and also dealing with a number of the issues that were outstanding last time, but rather perhaps which arose out of these engagements and so on. And really, you've given us food for thought here in a number of areas. Thank you very, very much for the submission and for your return. I'm just hearing from the committee secretary at this point. I know that some certainly honourable offender will be leaving.
That honourable members of parliament might have arising out of my submission. So I would just like very briefly to summarise my submission. One has to recognise that the economy is an extremely complicated entity, and this committee needs sector-specific inputs to appreciate the details. What I have tried to do is to draw attention to some of the common factors that influence downstream manufacturing industry, which is the much more labor-intensive component of industry as a whole, and why South Africa has effectively de-industrialized over the last few decades. The common factors have arisen from the exchange rate policy, which NARCAN have emphasized, the Fruit and Vegetable Canners Association emphasized that it is a common issue. And also the high cost of material inputs to downstream manufacturers arising out of past tariff policy. I might remind members that South Africa some 10, 20 years ago had one of the most complicated tariff systems in the world. I think only Thailand at that time had more tariff line items than South Africa. And I wanted to make some suggestions how these issues can be addressed. As Mr. Look remarked, South Africa's main problem is how to convert its material endowment into human development. We have this extraordinary wealth of minerals. What we want to do is to develop our human capacity. And I would like to make a remark on the comparatively low wages in Thailand versus the comparatively high wages in South Africa. One of the factors that one has to take into account is the family effect. That when you have only one member of a family who is employed, then the family is entirely dependent on the income of that member. As the employment rises and more members in a family become employed, then so the family can do with a lower wage per person, because the family then gets an income from more than one person. So there is a positive feedback if the employment rate rises, and a negative feedback if the employment rate drops. What I have suggested as a way in which South Africa's mineral wealth can possibly be converted is highlighted by the dispute at the moment between ArcelorMittal and Kumba. I suggested that the part of the existing tax burden on the mining industry can be linked to domestic beneficiation by way either of a rebate on taxes dependent on an incremental increase in beneficiation. In other words, at the moment, the total taxes paid would not be changed, but for any increase in the degree to which the minerals are beneficiated, the mines would be taxed less, and that they would, dependent on their local beneficiation percentage. Or alternatively, an export tax could be levied on local raw materials. There is an analogy in that the Department of Trade and Industry some time ago commissioned a report from an expert at the University of the Front, who pointed out that China levies an export duty of 40% on its metal scrap exports, India, I believe, 30%, and the Department of Trade and Industries recommended that such an export duty be levied in South Africa because South Africa exports billions of rands worth of metal scrap that go to China and India and come back as components that compete with South African manufacturers. I don't know why that has not been implemented. The gossip that I heard was that the obstacle was in the Treasury. Then I also suggested that by means perhaps of competition policy, the practice of industrial raw material manufacturers by which they export at lower prices than the prices they charge domestic customers, that practice could be changed by perhaps competition policy that would require them to not to discriminate against local manufacturers. That would then force an export parity pricing system, which would give South African manufacturers access to raw materials at internationally competitive prices. In fact, if it were an FOB export parity, it would mean that we would pay what the European and Japanese customers or Chinese customers pay for those raw materials minus the transport costs. And then finally, I did sketch the way in which the current situation developed, in which South African industry is heavily capital intensive, so that it employs relatively little labor. But regardless of the way in which that happened, those capital intensive industries are now national assets and should not be destroyed. And if they are forced to reduce their prices and therefore reduce their revenues by implementing export parity pricing, there should be a way to compensate them, and that would be through exchange rate policy. If the rand were to lower in value in rand dollar terms, so that the exporter got more rands for an export dollar, then all these companies, which are export orientated, steel, aluminium, and a huge variety of other raw materials, their rand revenues would rise, and if that were done carefully, it would compensate them for the reduction in revenue from local customers. I have in the meantime engaged the Director General for Economic Policy in the Treasury in an exchange of views. Also, the conversation has been joined by Dr. Michael Power, Dr. Christopher Lowald in the Treasury, and Dr. Michael Power have in the past in the press expressed contradictory views, and the three of us together are discussing the subject with the purpose of identifying points of difference, analyzing those, and trying to come to an agreement so that one can present a technically united front on these issues. I'd also just like to comment on the issue that the Honourable Maria raised. What return is there on money by whatever means Parliament allocates money, whether by direct investment incentives or by way of tax rebates or whatever, in these kinds of things? to get to arrive at the benefit, one has to use social cost benefit accounting. That for every person employed in industry, there is a person less receiving social benefit or dependent on social benefits. So that one has to take into account all the costs associated with unemployment when one evaluates the benefit of increasing the numbers of people employed. So I think I'll stop there and answer any questions that there might be.
Members of Sova to yourselves now on my left, Honourable Turok, Honourable van der Westhuizen, in that order please.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you, since you really work at the macro level, I'd like to ask you some rather basic issues which we face all the time. Broad questions. Some of us are very puzzled at the role of the state prior to 1994. The role of the state enterprises, ISCOR, the whole lot, FOSCOR, and so on. It seems that there was a very deliberate attempt by the National Party government to use all kinds of resources, and of course their gold taxes were very high. I've read documents about the rate of taxation of the gold industry in those days. I mean, the country virtually lived off the gold mining industry. So they were able to, they had a lot of money around and they were able to do those things. Now, how do we do the same? Because frankly, as an ANSI person, one is constantly talking about what can we legitimately do as a state. The Nationalist Party had no hesitation. They built those huge enterprises which we use now. Railways, the whole lot. So what can we do now which is reasonable, which for which there are resources? The second question is actually your social benefit cost. Why is it that our economists never introduce social benefit costs in any analysis? I mean, take crime. We people complain like anything about that we invest too much money in police or whatever, security. But the consequences of not doing that, and it seems to me, what's your indication about why we fail to do a total analysis of costs and always stick to the technical investment as opposed to the total benefit of an investment? Third one is the trade-off, and my last one, trade-off between an export approach and a domestic economy approach. Now, the IPAP begins to talk about the domestic economy, but you know, in the previous years of since 1994, it was always export, 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 you know, competitive export. We need to do both, clearly, but in your judgment, you know, what sort of weighting, what sort of advice would you give the committee? Because here we sit, we're having to make an adjustment on this kind of question around IPAP and all the other stuff we talk about. What sort of weighting should we give to, clearly we need to do both, but you need to weight where the emphasis should go. Should we give far more weight in the IPAP to the domestic economy, downstream and all that, or should we focus more on exports? I mean, here we heard something about the export of components. Well, component exports are very volatile. The market in export in components is up and down depending on many other factors. So, you know, where do we put the emphasis? I think your broad judgment on that sort of thing would help a lot.
Thank you, Honourable Turk, Honourable van der Westhuizen.
Chairperson, I'm very sorry that Honourable Turk missed the previous presentation by Dr. Wessels, because I think he would have loved it. Dr. Wessels, you have. Excellent. And you enjoyed it.
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Sorry, Chair. For those of you that weren't here, where Dr. Wessels strongly argued in terms of intervention in the exchange rates and weakening of the South African rand. Now, can I just ask, we've also heard the argument that, you know, cheap imports is to the benefit of the wider South African community, whereas, you know, mingling with the exchange rate is benefiting only those that are involved in export manufacturing, and that we have succeeded in bringing the cost of living down in many respects for many South Africans, apart from bringing inflation under control, etc. Now, can we get your comments, please, on the benefits for the wider community in terms of lower commodity prices, etc., versus the export-driven one, which may be to the detriment of local consumption and local produce. Thank you.
Thank you. It's over to yourself then, Dr. Bessels, please.
I need a quick question.
There
may be more.
Right. The role of the state prior to 1994, I've been in the manufacturing industry since 1971. Prior to 1994, the state spent huge amounts of money in developing nuclear weapons, nuclear power, armaments, and at the same time micromanaged the economy effectively in order to achieve their goals. To give one example, a high import duty was imposed on cotton, and that had nothing to do with the textile industry. That was because cotton is an essential element of rocket fuel. Now, as Professor Turok has pointed out, yes, there have been benefits. They did build large industries such as Sasol. Sasol is an example of success where South Africa has developed world competitive technology. But in many other instances, for example, the whole nuclear development, I think huge amounts of money were just wasted there, and we are left with next to nothing. What can we do now? Well, the thrust at the time was resource-orientated export projects. Those are quoting the words of Mr. Jeffrey Turner, who made the remark recently within the last 2 years in an engineering news article. And those industries are highly capital intensive. If you take capital intensity as the number of people employed per million rands invested, it rises markedly as you go downstream. And for example, the clothing industry is possibly the most highly labor intensive industries of all, which is why many of the Far Eastern countries have used the clothing industry as a vehicle for development. For example, the Toyota Motor Company grew out of the Japanese clothing industry. Why do economists not use social cost-benefit analyses? South African economists are very macroeconomic orientated. I was invited in 1992 to be a member of the Old Mutual Medco Professional Economic Panel, which was set up at that time to assist the new government in economic policy. Out of the 30 to 40 people in that group, which included the likes of Mr. Fonseil Slobbert, I was the only person who had ever worked in a factory. There has been very little communication between the economics, between the professional economists and business. They just are very macro-orientated. And moreover, they are dominated by bank economists. The Industrial Development Corporation, as an example, my company applied last year, or was the end of 2008, for assistance. The IDC was only interested in the profit they would earn. They did not pay any attention to the social costs and benefits. And moreover, they wanted personal guarantees of the profits that they wanted to, that they expected to earn from the shareholders. So
I can't really speak for the economists. I can only say that from my experience, it is true that very little attention has been paid to social cost-benefit analyses. On the trade-off between export-oriented and domestic economies, I think the major benefit of the exports is that it gives access to a very large market. If I can give an example, we manufactured flanges for exhaust systems incorporating catalytic converters. As Mr. Luke pointed out, that has been one of the large export successes. Had we manufactured for the local market, I believe it's somewhere in the vicinity of 500,000 vehicles. Now, we were manufacturing 30,000 components per week, and the huge bulk of that was exported. So we were able to design and build special purpose machines that highly automated the process and brought down the unit costs. So the productivity rises dramatically when one has high volumes. And if one confines oneself only to the local market, then you just can't achieve those high volumes. I can't really answer the question technically what sort of weighting should be given to export or domestic enterprises. In my opinion, considering the complexity of the economy, the emphasis should be primarily on creating conditions in which entrepreneurs can be successful, because one finds the most surprising economic successes, the most surprising business successes that emerge when conditions are favorable. And it is not possible for a central body to predict what might be successful or what might not be. I think the Soviet Union was a prime example of the difficulty of central management of the economy, where, for example, truck manufacturers didn't have enough chassis to produce trucks, so they had to buy buses, or vice versa, bus manufacturers, that they had to buy trucks and dismantle the trucks and use the chassis to make buses. So I would suggest that the most efficient way of developing is to create conditions in which entrepreneurs can succeed. But I'm not saying that there should not be any central attention to champion industries or that may well be. I'm not qualified to comment on that. Then the answer from the Honourable von der Westhuizen. The trade-off between cheap imports versus expensive local manufacturer. I think the prime example is clothing, where one can go to Mr. Price and you can get clothing for remarkably low prices. And here we want to develop our own textile industry, and we have to do that by raising the prices in order to make it competitive. Well, the bigger the market that the clothing industry can serve, the less you would have to raise the price to make it competitive, because they would be able then to reach economies of scale. But the benefit is then the greater of the number of people that you employ. The example here is the Far Eastern countries, which prototype was Taiwan, which developed this approach in the 1950s, where they exposed quite a number of the fallacies that were prevalent at that time in economic policy, and some of them of which are still prevalent in this country, such as that a developing country needs a strong currency in order to reduce the cost of capital inputs. The fact is that exporters, their revenues are in foreign currency. Their imported inputs are in foreign currency, so that when the rand weakens, for example, their revenues rise to such a degree that their return on the more expensive capital equipment also rises, despite the rise in rands of the cost of the capital equipment. So in fact, a depreciating currency increases the return that exporters get on their capital investments. And if you take the case of those countries, Taiwan and all the other so-called Far Eastern tigers, they were able to increase the level of employment. China now is the example par excellence, where in the last 20 years or so, they've lifted 500,000,000 people out of poverty. So it's a question of the number of people you employ versus the cost of consumables that they buy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Vessels, for that. Wanted to ask one little question myself here. On page 2 of the document you've just handed out here, and I think it was in the previous document as well, you referred to the acquisition of capital and so on, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the fourth paragraph, the reason behind that. You say, talking about the production costs, etc., this required capital then, the last sentence here, and capital is necessary to survive until sales volumes have risen, etc., and then more capital would be required to buy the expensive equipment that is necessary at the higher volumes. If you look at the whole paragraph, but take that point about finance, capital finance, in your opinion, do you think that that sort of funding or finance, that development finance institutions may be able to effectively serve that with the right leveraging structure from government in that regard to supply either guarantees or support in the differential between the affordable interest rate on it and what is charged commercially?
Indeed, Madam Chair, in the USA...
Can I just ask something a bit related to that?
Yes, thank you, Honourable Tourist.
Mr. Pick, you know, we are getting different messages about the desire in the private sector to invest. Some people are saying there's disinvestment on a big scale. Other people are showing examples where the private sector is investing. We're talking about industry now. In your experience, which is true, or is it both? Is the private sector, in broad terms, willing to invest in industry at the moment or not?
Madam Chair, the answer to the question, the second question, is no. At the moment, my experience is that the private sector does not is not interested in investing. Part of the reason is because I believe the banks took a deliberate decision many years ago that they will only lend based on documents. Whereas in the USA, I did my master's degree in business administration at Harvard University, and there they had the concept of the loan officer who was trained to be able to evaluate a business on its merits. South African banks don't have people with the competence to evaluate the viability of an investment. They simply operate on the basis of security. You have to mortgage your house, you have to more or less sell yourself. And the IDC at the moment also operates on that basis, very much as a private bank. In California, the venture capital industry plays that role. They will put up huge amounts of capital in to finance promising investment propositions. And that is how, for example, Apple Computer arose, and many other companies of that nature. They have that orientation. It is lacking in South Africa. So if a development finance institution like the IDC had properly trained people, and once again, if my advice and the gossip amongst my colleagues is any guide to go by, there are few, if any, of the IDC's analysts that they send out who are really competent to assess the viability of an investment. Training schemes need to be introduced there.
Dr. Vessel, thank you once again. I think we have all certainly learned much from this particular submission, and we hope to keep in touch in the future as we move through our oversight on EPA. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Members of the committee, tea will be there in a few minutes if it is not already there. but I would, what I would like to do, as I said earlier, is to just, and I think on the tour, coming forward, and then also what Na referred to, Honorable Hadeli made this suggestion, and I think we accepted it, that these should be preliminary observations at this point, because we haven't absolutely finalized issues. And then, of course, the introduction, in which I have already shown to one or two people some changes I thought could be made. And the final thing is to agree that the site visit to Grand West Casino does effectively reflect the position of that small core group that went there. So the way we'll do this is first the site visit to Grand West Casino. We've all had the opportunity to study this. We would have liked to have put some of this into an annexure. It's two pages of information there. As you know, the annexure immediately accompanies the executive summary. It's not that it's a separate document. It is a separate attachment, but it's pinned together there. It's right on the ABC. So if you can agree on the principle that part of that be included in the annexure, then you can just indicate either yourself, Honourable Mandeventhasen, and perhaps supported then by Honourable Hadebe, what we could best retain in the executive summary on page 12, 13, and 14. And you'll agree, and we'll adopt on that basis.
Chair, with moving that to an annexure, I'm completely in support of that. Just with the recommendations, I've also sent through some which I don't quite see being included in here. And I was just wondering if at this late stage I could just point it out. I feel very strongly that the way in which gambling is advertised at present in our country is misleading. Mm-hmm. If you only present it as a way to get rich and you don't inform people of the risks to also become poor, then I believe it's misleading advertising. And therefore, I would like us as a recommendation now, and especially if this other commission that's working on the review of gambling, etc., can just come back to us later in the year and say, you know, is it possible in terms of the legislation that we have at present? And I've added the 9.7 recommendation that ways to curb advertising that presents gambling as a way to get rich, and stronger warnings regarding the risks associated with gambling should be considered. Ways to curb advertising that presents gambling as a way to get rich. And stronger warnings against the risks. Associated with gambling should be considered.
Well, I don't need the concern I've been already made.
Members, you can see that coming up on the screen immediately. You know, Honorable Turok, I know you want to get this out the way. But I've never heard such a false support. No, I would hope we can just apply our minds. I mean, let's at least read it. Ways to curb, right. As he smiles, I'm not sure if that means everyone is in agreement. Are we all in agreement? All right. Okay. So that's already received approval as a recommendation. Fine. Are we then You know, I've merely noted you put the recommendations in case they would require changes and if people don't accept them. So what I'm going to do now, members, is to read one, not read, but you can read it yourself, 9.1. Accepted. 9.2. 9.3. 9.4. Wait, someone raised a hand. I think Honourable Hurling, Ms. Hurling's been watching too many of these high noon movies. 9.5. There, the spelling, huh? There, and there deprived. There, okay. I just want to check with yourself, Honourable Van der Vestes, and you know when you spoke about the risks, you were, of course, focusing on the advertising, per se. Okay. No, that's fine, because I just see the families referred to here.
Chair, under 9.5, just a few words that I would like to add, if possible. Instead of starting with measures, we could ask, add the word stronger measures need to be put in place. Stronger measures, because there are measures already. But what we've heard is that the current ones are not effective.
There was a sad case reported in the paper just last week, of course, yes. When I say sad, actually a tragic case. 9.6. 9.7. I mean, we've already been over that yet. Now, Honourable Lavinia had no problem, and I'm sure she would also give that her support. Then we go back, members, to preliminary observations. Nothing is, well, 8.1 to 8.5 or 8.4 is not new. The only thing new is the paragraph introducing it. During the final phase, of course, we were informed of the commission, you recall, and when we were informed of that, we then took a decision that, in a sense, we would, these could only be preliminary observations, but that it would be important for us not to delay the report. We should take what we have to the House. Nevertheless, we do, when we've seen the final report, words to the effect that we will then study that report of the Commission and once again exercise oversight and deliberate and take a final report, Honourable Turok, towards the end of the year, and I'm sure that will only occupy one or two of our meetings at that point in time. So there we are. So are we all agreed on the preliminary observations? Fine. Page one. You will see some of that coming into this. It's noted there. The page one, I'm not looking at it myself. Where is it here? Page, that of course is the introduction, page, paragraph one, two, I can't see the Hurling's going so fast. I mean, you're not on Kailani. After studying the principal legislation, you know, this is the thing. We have a racing driver here. You know. In the middle of the last, of that last part before contextual, you'll see that it wasn't really our issue on the morality per se, because in one sense, notwithstanding what we may say colloquially, we're here to look at the socio meaning the broader issues of economic impact. So it was on that basis that although it was there before, I have asked for it to be deleted, and then we focus on the local community, which I think addresses issues such as the family, and then society in general. Otherwise, nothing else has been changed. Are we agreed then? Having agreed then, can we with only one change where we would say thank you to those who made their submissions and those who processed the report. Can we have someone to raise their hand if they believe we can adopt the report, preliminary report? Well, I'm going to take that as the seconder, Honourable Turok, in case it looks like we didn't apply our minds. Honourable Van der Westhuizen. Honourable Van der Westhuizen proposed, seconded by Honourable Turok. Thank you. Look, no, thank you most sincerely for all your applications to this, and we'll come back to it. And we do need a letter to the minister requesting at the earliest opportunity a copy of that, of the report of the commission, at the earliest. And I want to thank the Honourable Mabato for leaving his other committee to come and adopt. Thank you. And thank you to those who are waiting here to make submissions for your time. 5 minute tea break. Help yourself to tea. Have a comfort break and please bring your goodies back. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think we'll be as long as 20 minutes. We'll try to keep it very short. And Madam Chair, thank you for just clearing it up, what really was expected of us. Because when we saw the agenda when we came in, we were a little bit confused whether we were in the right committee. So thank you for clearing it up. Madam Chair, we as a municipality and as the Etiquette municipality, we obviously understand and fully appreciate the critical role that vehicles and plant play in terms of delivery of services. We run a fleet of 6,000 vehicles, plants, and buses, including buses. Our fleet values around two and a half billion rand. We spend approximately 270 million rand per annum on the replacement of vehicles and plants, which equates to some 400 vehicles. The municipality has taken a decision to employ or adopt a standardization policy for vehicles. The standardization policy makes it very clear that we will support local industry, support manufacturers that have manufacturing bases in South Africa. And Madam Chair, we're in full agreement with your sentiments of supporting the local industry, and 98% of our vehicle fleet is produced in South Africa. Obviously, we limited, Madam Chair, in the influence of local content, and etc. But as a municipality, we have supported it, and we will continue to support it. We've standardized our fleet. We've been across the country and to look at what the major metros are doing. And a lot of them are having difficulties in procurement regarding tendering processes and things like that. And we came up with this, with the process of standardizing, creating categories in each vehicle type where we said we look at two vehicle models or three. Some of the philosophy behind it was we took a snapshot and a census of what the fleet looked like a few years ago and then based that rationale on that. But the benefits we've seen successful or really beneficial areas in terms of service delivery, in terms of availability for standardization. Our current availability of our fleet is around about 96%. Our technical people, our artisans, are trained to deal with a product. So the training and skills transfer is really focused in terms of the standard vehicle. We have standard equipment that we purchase so that we ensure that the asset is maintained according to manufacturer specifications. Our workshop facilities are all geared up to deal with the standard equipment. We've managed to negotiate spare part contracts because of the large volumes of a type of vehicle with the manufacturers. In certain areas, the manufacturers have made us dealers so that we can minimize and reduce costs. We've also, there's a lot of training that's been provided by the manufacturers because we can focus on their product. So they provide a driver training for our people. Driver training is a crucial thing, and driver skills in our country is really critical right now. and driver behavior, because it has a big impact on the maintenance and the just operating cost of the vehicle. So our focus is really the standardization has brought a whole range of benefits to our organization. And the primary one is just availability. 96% availability, even the private sector really has a problem getting up to that level. They look at 90%. At times of availability is just at about 97%. But our real focus, Madam Chair, I'm just reiterating again, is focused on supporting South African industry. 98% of our fleet, which is of 6,000 vehicles, is quite a lot, is produced in South Africa. The balance is vehicles that have manufacturing bases in South Africa, but the model is not running in South Africa. For argument's sake, our high-speed police vehicle is a Jetta. It was produced in South Africa, has now been produced in Brazil, just in terms of how the model's running and how they changed their production lines. Madam Chair, just on the buses, which you sent in your letter to us, we went out to tender in March 2009 for buses, for commuter buses. A total of 66 buses were purchased. All 66 buses were assembled in South Africa, and bodies were built in South Africa. None of those buses were directly imported from foreign locations. In terms of specialized vehicles, Madam Chair, we can give you an example of, in terms of the fire service. Historically, the fire service imported their emergency vehicles, and the fire engine came in from parts of Europe and the US. And really, it cost us 10 years ago. A fire engine was costing us around 3 million rand. Actually 15 years ago. And if we had a problem with the vehicle, a downtime, we would be 3 months just waiting for the windscreen. So we pioneered with the local vehicle manufacturer, with a bodybuilder, and we pioneered and we developed a fire engine, if you can call it that, in inverted commas, which the industry calls a rescue pump, which is now used extensively in South Africa. I think every major fire service and miner has that vehicle, which is fully developed in South Africa. So, you know, we've pioneered local products there, local content. We did it in our refuse vehicle fleet. We did it in our water, high pressure cleaning, sewage cleaning fleet. So our real focus and as a municipality is on creating South African, creating South African jobs. We are limited in terms of our input and involvement in terms of the content, which was raised earlier, the park content, which I think is a critical factor of reducing that to a higher value in South Africa than rather importing it. So, Madam Chair, that's really our presentation. We've provided in our documentation to you the policy on our replacement policy. We provided a 5-year replacement model in terms of how we replace our vehicles, and we provided our standardization policy, which we developed and implemented. So that's it, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Right. Open to questions then. Honourable Kotsi, Honourable Tura, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Murray.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, first let me thank the presenters and as well congratulate them for being proudly South African. But I would want to know now that at least they have been ahead perhaps of EPUB in terms of the local manufacturing and procuring. There is an issue that EPUB is highlighting very strongly. Perhaps it's an area that we want to know how green are your buses in terms of the environment, because that's another area that EPUB is actually emphasizing. Perhaps once you can see that you have managed to comply with one and really be South African, then we need to look at other areas if they could explain.
Thanks very much. Very good news from you, and clearly your EPUB friendly or observant compliant is the word I wanted. EPUB compliant before EPUB existed. So thanks very much. I want to ask you a slightly sensitive question. Since you're doing so much local procurement, how do you stop tender fraud? How do you deal with the whole question of corruption? Is it a problem? If so, what is the scale? If not, congratulations.
Right. Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'll also follow my colleagues, in appreciating the presentation, in particular the speed with which they responded. When we made the call on Tuesday, I was wondering whether they were going to make it for two. So then the afternoon, that one is highly appreciated. And then I also want to put a perspective of the committee, why it is so urgent. You know, when you look at the United States of America, their unemployment rate is at 9%. And then President Obama said that is a national crisis. And then our unemployment rate was, for the past 10, 15 years, it always been above 24%. So that's why that we have to do things differently, so that we can fight the scale of unemployment, scale of poverty. So what I would like to appreciate with this presentation is that definitely we are ahead of IPA from what we're getting here. So that's why it must be appreciated. And then, but what I want to ask is that I liked the part where you said that you train artisans within the municipality itself who are trained by the manufacturer. So how many artisans I was speaking about which were trained within the past 5 years? How many artisans were trained? Because part of growing the economy is to skill the people. That one is the bottom line. And then number two, what I'd also like to ask, if you have any imports, take example the TTI, has got this National Industrial Participation Program, whereby when they invest more than $10 million outside the country, there must be counter-investment into the country. Do you have such a policy within the municipality? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to find out, in terms of your procurement policies, specifically about the vehicles and buses and trucks, you say that 98% of your fleet is manufactured in South Africa. I mean, how sure are you about that? Or is it only from local manufacturers that you have purchased it? Because all vehicles from local manufacturers are assembled in South Africa. So I just want to get assurance of that. Then, in terms of, I see in your procurement of buses, you only request a participation goal of a minimum of 10% of the contract value to be South African content. That's quite low in terms of the objectives, you know, of IPAP, that we must have 70% local content. So those are the things that we are looking for in terms of future. You might be committed to IPAP now and go for locally manufactured vehicles, but if your procurement policy says 10%, then that is incredibly low, so then it's not that good. In terms of your need, I mean, the 66 buses, I presume this is for this rapid transport, this is new, or yeah, this IRT bus, is it for that? If not, you know, where do you get that then from? And in terms of going forward, you know, looking at the possibility of a manufacturing industry for buses and trucks, how would your requirements be going forward? You know, you've bought now 66 buses, and you said that you replace them, I think, every 5 years. Now, is that a 66 per year, or is it only, you know, is it only going to be in the 5 year period that you replace 66? Thank you very much.
Thank you. There's just one or two questions I have. I also focused on that low 10% that has been raised. Would it be useful to, if you had have some sort of business model that was projecting to increase that somewhat and how it would be increased? You made one reference to, of course, the jets have been bought outside the country without value and that kind of thing. I wondered if Jetta is the only kind of vehicle your police services could use, because I understand there are others assembled in the country. I do know the Jetsons go very fast, but so do BMs and a few others. Then the other aspect is the fire engines. You know, it would be useful in this regard. It sounds like the company that together with you, pioneered the development of its own fire engine or whatever, is now selling to other municipalities and so on. What is the cost of that, and how much has been saved by doing it in this particular way? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the first question regarding the green issue, Madam Chair, we've just brought in a hybrid vehicle, a commercial vehicle, that will be running along our beachfront, a refuse vehicle. And we've got it in the first in the country. We've got it on the trial at the moment. We've had it on a truck show that we just launched for all municipalities. We had a truck show in November last year, where we had a whole range of our vehicles on, and we invited all municipalities to come and look at what we're using. This was quite a successful show. A lot of the municipalities bought on our tender, on our contracts, and we had this truck on show. So we are thinking of green. In terms of our new buses, we spec them with a higher engine, so emissions have been reduced. And that's the program in which we're approaching the environmental issues. In terms of tender fraud, the issue there, Madam Chair, we haven't had any tender fraud on vehicles. We benchmark the prices. We look at what we're getting from the manufacturers. We look at state contracts. We look at historic prices. So it's very, very, it's actually below those costs. So we've had excellent success there. I can't say that that's the case for everything else, but I can guarantee on the vehicle side it's very clean and above board. The issue regarding unemployment and the question of artisans trained, we've had approximately 120 artisans trained through the process with the manufacturers. We've also initiated a process called recognition of prior learning, where we had artisan assistants who were employed with us for 15 to 20 years and really could do what an artisan could do, but really was in a dead-end kind of career. And we used just his understanding and his skills level of doing the job, did some testing with him, with the individual, and we've had success where we've moved 20 or 25 of them from just general skilled, unskilled people to skilled people. So it's really around those things, and our real focus is to skill and to really cook these, and to create a further skill pool for the private sector to draw from us. At the moment, we're busy bringing in 20 learnership programs into the department that will help upskill these people and then also get them marketable for jobs in the private sector. With regard to the question on the 98% manufactured, that's factual. The vehicles that are not manufactured in South Africa are bought through a local South African manufacturer. For example, the Volkswagen Jetta, the Toyota Quantum, which is spoken earlier, that's not manufactured yet, unfortunately not. But those kind of vehicles are coming through the South African agent or the manufacturer. But 98% of our vehicles is factual. A large part of the fleet is Isuzu, manufactured in Port Elizabeth. Toyota, coming out of the Toyota factory in Prospect and in Durban. Volkswagen, coming out of the Utenek plant. Nissan, coming out of the Rosman plant in Pretoria. So it's factual. Madam Chair, the question around the 66 buses, those buses were, 23 of those buses were brought in for our, we call it inner city transport system. They're low entry buses, they're similar to the people movers or to the buses that they use in other major cities, also locally built in terms of body and chassis, and the chassis developed or assembled locally. The balance of the buses, the other 43, were commuter buses, standard commuter buses. In terms of the business plan or the projected replacement of buses, we're running the current bus model fleet is about 500 buses. We give a bus an average lifespan of 10 years, so approximately 50 buses per annum, which equates to about 75 million rand in today's times. Madam Chair, regarding the the question on the 10%. I think it maybe sort of it might be we might have skewed it in terms of how we put it. The 10% was beyond our normal empowerment equity issues, a scorecard, which includes equity management control, etc., etc. But in terms of the value on the bus itself, 17% of the chassis, 17% of the chassis is local, and 85% of the body is local. So I think maybe we could have just where we presented that could be skewed in a sense. The body is really the panels are built in South Africa. The whole thing is done in South Africa. It's just the steelwork. We spec 3CR12 steel because of the corrosive nature of Durban in terms of the being a coastal city, etc., etc. So a lot of that stuff is sourced from local suppliers. Madam Chair, just getting back on that question of the on the fire engine, there's been significant savings. In 1996, 1995, 96, we bought in two rescue pump units from the US. They cost us, worked out to 3.7 million rand then. We got the price of the rescue pump down in today's prices to 2.3 million rand. So it's been a significant savings. If you factor in real, just in real terms, what that 3.7 will be worth today, so it's been significant. And also the bottom line on this is that it's got local support. If a windscreen cracks, you can get that off the shelf. So that's been really sort of a successful thing, and we're just hoping that more municipalities take this on. We are talking to our partners as a major metros. We met with our Cape Town colleagues. Colleagues from Nelson, Mandela Bay, Johannesburg, and the like, just to encourage them to move onto this local and the standardization approach. So I hope I've answered all your questions, Madam Chair.
Is this Honourable Khadebe just raised that?
All right, I'm raising the issue of the national industrial participation program. I can see that their component is very South African, but that one gives a threshold target of 10 million. And if there's a procurement of more than 10 million abroad, and then there must be counter investment in South Africa. We have such a policy that if we don't have, what do we have for the future so that we can really keep as much money as possible in the country?
Madam Chair, we don't have that in our procurement sort of structures. We will take it away and just review that and just look at deal with our procurement and infrastructure department just to look at how we can bring that in to create that rebate.
Yes, I think that would be very helpful, and I'm sure DTI, the Department of Trade and Industry, would be very happy to engage on any clarifications and EPUB 2 that you would require in this regard. But I really must once again say we are really very impressed with your positive and swift response in getting here. It's not our normal practice to ring someone up 2 days beforehand, but we're actually facing a huge crisis in our country right now. Unemployment, as the Honourable Khadebe has raised, but I think all parties sitting here in the committee would agree that there has been a dramatic decline in the industrial base. And the support for local industry and manufacturing is absolutely critical if we're going to raise employment. So really, as I said, it's not our normal practice, but I always say, if you're fighting a war and you're getting ready for a battle, you don't wait a week to sort of change around the movements or resources that are there trying to support you. You do it immediately, the environment changes. So thank you most sincerely again. Thank you. We now, according to the schedule I have, and I don't know if that was pre-arranged in terms of timing, we have the Department of Public Enterprises. But I don't know if it was worthwhile not having the two metros together. That's the reason why that's
about 4.2 billion rand. And that would cover about 10% of
Cape Town's commuting public. So we've got a big rollout ahead of us, a long time to roll out this project. The current implementation program we're working to will see us completing this in September 2013, this first phase. However, with the recent funding allocations that were given in terms of the Division of Revenue Act, we've had a substantial increase in allocations, and we are currently looking at revising our implementation program. So some of the numbers I'm going to quote you relate to an old program. We're looking at reshuffling this and trying to do a few things to help reduce our operating costs. But essentially, there are four a couple of areas in the project, three areas in particular, which relate to the various sectors, that IMAP sectors of the capital and transport equipment, the metal fabrication, and the automotive components. And there's three elements of the project that touch on that is the IRT vehicles, that's our buses, our IRT station top structures, those are the main stations on our trunk routes, and then the IRT stops. And just briefly, a way of background, our first phase, we're looking at an estimated cost of our vehicles in the order of R500,000. That excludes that. And that would mean procuring in the order of 90 18-meter vehicles and 12-meter trunk service vehicles and nearly 200 smaller vehicles, about 8 to 9 meters in length. Our station top structures, and these are the, I don't know if you've seen some of the glass structures that are going up in some of the roadways around Cape Town. Granger Bay is an example near the stadium outside the Civic Centre. There are 69 station platforms and boxes. I call them glass boxes that we're constructing, and those are manufactured from steel, aluminium, and glass, all locally sourced, manufactured in Cape Town, and assembled on site. And then again, the IRT stops. These will be stops that will be erected at all the feeder stops. We have two vehicle classes, our trunk vehicles and our feeder vehicles, and the feeder vehicles are the smaller vehicles that will run around in the city, residential areas, industrial areas, and the stops there, and they are in the order of the first phase, 550-odd stops at a value of about R160 million. The balance of the work is basically civil engineering work, like you see going on. And just as a matter of interest, I did a quick assessment of the value of the steel that's going into the reinforced concrete roadway that you see going down, the sort of red-colored road. It's about 1% of the total contract value. It's not an insubstantial amount of steel for a civil contract. Our progress to date, we've actually made an award to a supplier for 43 trunk vehicles. The value of that award is R101.5 million. Tenders were called for in terms of the City of Cape Town supply chain management policy, and the tender call was publicly advertised. In the tender documentation, there were a notice to tenderers regarding the requirements of the National Industrial Participation Program. And supporting document was provided in the tender documentation for tenderers to review and enable them to make contact with DTI and the other departments that they needed to. Unfortunately, I was just trying to look to see if we had a minimum requirement for local content in the contract documentation. I couldn't recall and I couldn't find it. But what we did do is we included in our scoring of tenders, we included a number of points for local content, not only manufactured in South Africa, but we were trying to solicit some local manufacturing in Cape Town. We didn't score really anything in the Cape Town area, but locally, all the tenders submitted were very much in a similar ballpark in that area and were taken into account. The successful contractor has actually commenced and completed the construction of the two prototype vehicles. That's the 18-meter vehicle and the 12-meter vehicle. We haven't gone ahead with an award for the smaller 8.8-meter vehicles at this stage, and hopefully that will follow fairly soon. Just in terms of progress, we have to import the chassis and engine components. They're all imported, but being assembled locally. With the exception of the 18-meter articulated vehicles, we've had to have the chassis assembled overseas and shipped here in an assembled format, and that's purely because of the very tight deadlines we have for the 2010 World Cup, and we need these vehicles to service to provide services during that period. In terms of body fabrication and assembly, that's been done completely in South Africa. The steel, fiberglass, and glass components are all being sourced locally. And I've been advised that the local content, the manufacturing content, in terms of value is about 60% of the vehicle. I was advised that I haven't been able to check it, but that's the figure that was given to me earlier this morning. Included in that contract, we have an opportunity for driver training. We're actually in the process of driving the initial 55 drivers and another about 80 further to follow. That's part of that same contract. We also have an option to train service staff and some maintenance staff as part of the contract, but we're going to delay that to post the 2010 event and the relationships and the arrangements we're having with our operator, which is a company that's set up from the various taxi industries in and around the CBD. It will get everything finalized there. We've actually successfully negotiated a contract with the first operating company for IRT, and we're quite pleased with that. It's one of our major milestones, so we're well on our way with that. The station substructures, as I mentioned earlier, there was nearly 300 million rands worth of work coming out there. We've made an award to the value of about 100, oh, sorry, this value is wrong, it was 130, 129 million rand. And our station, the stops on the side of the road, we haven't proceeded with that contract at this stage. That will all follow post-2010. Unfortunately, my time to prepare this, I didn't have time to actually raise issues and concerns, but during some of the deliberations, I've dotted out a few points, and some of the concerns and issues that are affecting the IRT program is one of the issues is sustainable funding. It's an issue that we need to be, we grapple with every day. In terms of the DORA allocations, we're given an indication from Treasury of what our financial contributions are likely to be over the next three-year period. Currently, the current year is guaranteed, the outer 2 years are indicative, and we've had to adjust our programs accordingly, so we can't commit to works in outer years, and it makes it very difficult in a project of this scale where one would like to commit to projects in a longer term, but one has to basically curtail it to the financial year within which those allocations are actually made. Our CFO is quite adamant on that and won't allow us to commit to funding beyond funding that we don't actually have guaranteed in the bank. The second point, and it follows on from the point that the two gentlemen from the motor industry made, is the production of a passenger carrier. And it's something that we don't have in this country. And to have a passenger carrier, something between the current Quantum and the 12-meter buses that you see running around Cape Town in the sort of 8.5 to 9-meter vehicle, it's something that we would really appreciate having that opportunity to be able to source that locally. We did go out and attend for that vehicle. We expect a particular vehicle initially, our feeder services. The financial situation and some of basically did permit us to proceed with a tender, but we found, notwithstanding that, we found that we had no compliant tenders that were returned. So that is a concern to us. And then another point that was mentioned earlier, which I touched on, is the cost of transport between place of employment and place of residence. That is a factor that we face every day in Cape Town, and I see that regularly. I'm actually a transport planner from the city of Cape Town. That's my background. I'm not a mechanical engineer or a... it is a real issue. We see just recently the big housing projects that have gone ahead in Cape Town. It troubles me that we put in a lot of effort into housing and moving people and relocating people, but we're not putting the same amount of effort into creating opportunities for industry, commercial, industrial, to be located in close proximity to create employment opportunities close to where these residential areas are. That is a personal concern that I'd like to just raise here as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, then, Ms. Martez. Honourable Turok, Honourable Kotsi, Honourable Murray.
You know, listening to the presentation from two local government agencies, it strikes me that let me put the question. Do all the local government agencies which are now purchasing infrastructure equipment and so on, do they talk to each other? Because the question of it sounds to me like the economies of scale in South African production is dependent on cooperation between everyone. So if you need whatever vehicles you require, do you talk to other people and say, let's get together and do a joint? Is there any cooperation at all? That's the first thing. And second thing is, I'm asking you the same question about corruption. Are you convinced that your system is corruption-proof?
Thank you. Honourable Kotsi.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I don't know whether I had the speaker well, that in terms of the passenger carrier, whether he was saying there's no local content on that, and he can correct me if I'm wrong. And if that is so, I am also aware that there's a system being built in South Africa where if for once that content or item is not available in South Africa, that somehow the second tranche should be done with the training or perhaps in terms of the joint venture with a South African company, so that we don't continuously get these. In terms of, I see there you actually put your tender and perhaps the factors that were taken into consideration. Were there any joint ventures around the people that actually got the tender when applying for this? And because sometimes some of them, it would be finances that actually cause problems for them not to qualify, even though they would have a bit of more of what is needed. If the Stella could respond to that.
Thank you,
Chair. Obviously, as you can, you can see from our reactions, local content is and local beneficiation is obviously critical and important. So my first criticism is obviously, your tender documents will have to, look at the requirements in terms of local content. Because without that, then you're not really supporting us. In terms of what you've said about that chassis fabrication and assembly where that is imported, that is obviously, as you've said, is now that has been imported. What will happen in the future? And obviously, I don't know from who you procure that, but I mean, will they be in a position to manufacture that in the future? And what will be your requirements or needs for buses and trucks in the years to come? Again, to try to qualify whether there's enough support for an industry like that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. The question I'm going to ask here is not based on the content here, but I'm going to ask the policy around that issue. For example, I appreciate that when you award the tenders, you consider the issue of the historical disadvantaged individuals, whatever. But then also what is good is issue of the local content. I can see that you said HDI is 10%, quality 45%, of which 4%, local content amount to 44%. Yeah. What I want to ask around this issue is the issue of import funding. You find that someone might be, say it's a local entrepreneur. Yeah. But what happens is that whatever you need, he or she sources it from abroad. Do you have a mechanism within the tender system to clear up such a mess of that nature? Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Marquez, when you looked at the whole project, as it were, you spoke about the total cost of the IRT project is 4.2 billion across the board. Capital works amounting to 3.5 billion. Now, in a ballpark figure, what is the amount of money or percentage that is locally sourced? Manufactured, sourced, labor, whatever. But this is capital, actually, so but obviously not labor at this point. We're talking about. Do you have the figure with you? If you don't, you're very welcome just to email us that figure. We wouldn't have to have it right now. And then just the one little thing here at the end where the, you talk about the, I think it was the steel and aluminium and whatever structures that you've got around the place and glass. You said all of that is produced here, even that glass structure, or top or roof, in Cape, in the Western Cape. Thank you.
To the first question regarding local government cooperation, at the initiation of this project, I wasn't directly involved, but I know there were one or two consultants that were working across the various cities at the time, assisting National Department of Transport and the various cities trying to pull things together. I have However, I don't believe that the cooperation was close enough. It's certainly improving. There are now meetings between the various cities. We haven't met with Durban yet, particularly on this matter, but certainly with Tshwane and the city of Joburg, there have been officials and their consultants have come down to Cape Town. We've been up to Johannesburg as well to discuss not only this aspect, but other aspects of the project. Not specifically in relation to procurement, but in relation to the project as a whole. Again.
Maybe I know Honourable Jurgwe, you know, there is, perhaps you can just add something afterwards as a clarification.
Okay, in response to the question regarding corruption, I believe that the City of Cape Town's supply chain management policy is a pretty robust policy. It's as robust as we can make it. If somebody finds a way to try and guard against it. The adjudication processes are very important in this case, and that was done in this particular case with the vehicles here was done really by an independent group, independent from those that actually produced the specification. We kept them separate. We made sure that everything was above board, locked away, and we go through a pretty rigorous process to make sure that we keep things above board. In terms of the maybe a point of clarity around the passenger carrier and the point that members seem to think that I've maybe gotten there was no local content. The point I wanted to make in terms of the smaller carrier, we didn't have a successful tenderer for the smaller carrier, so we didn't proceed with that. In terms of the larger trunk vehicles, certainly there was a local content specified. The minimum quantity I can't find in the documentation. It doesn't appear as if we had a minimum quantity specified, but we certainly allocated points for preferential points for those that had a higher local content than others. We did include the national industrial programs documentation in the documentation, in the tender documentation to advise tenderers of the obligations in terms of the NIP program. I don't know if that satisfies your question, answers your question, but maybe we can clarify that. I can come back to that if necessary. Regarding the question on the chassis that were manufactured overseas, this was just a one-stop case, or assembled overseas. The intention is that in future we'll have those chassis for this particular contract. Any further 18-meter vehicles that are procured, the chassis will be assembled locally, all up in Johannesburg, at the plant in Johannesburg where this is done. The reason why we couldn't do it, as I said, was the time frames and the production schedules at the various plants where these things were put together. We just couldn't get them in prior to having the vehicles completed for the 2010 World Cup event, and that was an essential requirement. So one of the reasons we actually went ahead with this tender at this stage was actually to get these vehicles in for 2010. Otherwise, we would have probably delayed this a little bit later, until a little bit later. But so in future, our goal would be to have the vehicles assembled, the chassis assembled, as much work done locally as possible. There was a question raised regarding support for local industry. Certainly, I'm
so quiet.
My apologies. The question regarding support for local industry are certainly it is our intent. It's always been our intention to support local industry. That is quite clear in our tender documentation. I think our failing is, and that's the point, is that we didn't have a minimum requirement in there for local content. We raised the issue. We had a scoring opportunity, preferential scoring for those that had greater local content. They would get more points, but no minimum quantity in there. And I think that's something we need to address. I think that really addresses the follow-up question regarding only 4% local content. Again, we need to improve that. I made some cryptic notes here. I'm trying to decipher them. The last two questions, please. On import fronting. Yep.
Right. Were those questions on the global figures? of billions.
No, I'll come back to that. There's an issue here on import fronting.
Honorable Khadebe's question. Thank you, Chair. I said that within their procurement policy or tender policy, do they have any mechanisms there to avoid import fronting? I made an example that you can have an historical disadvantage individual gaining the tender, but find that that person imports the goods from the other countries. Do you have within your system ways of monitoring that aspect?
Thank you for the repeat question. I'm sure it is contained in our supply chain management policy. However, I cannot explicitly give you a reference to that now. Maybe I suggest if I can forward a copy of our policy documentation, that will probably be the best way to answer that. Okay, thank you. The last question on, or the question regarding the percentage of capital, what's the local, that I'd have to come back to you on, because that is and I take it that you're referring to all works, including civil works.
On this project.
So it'll be the total on the capital component. And thank you.
Honourable Kotsi, and then I do know Honourable Turek wanted to do a follow-up there.
Chair, I just want to say, I just want to ask this question. It might not have an answer now, but that it could be. You know, this EPAP is about sustainable jobs, you know, and growing the industry. At the end of this whole project, how many jobs do you think would have created sustainable jobs in this industry? I mean, if you have already, you got that. And your previous response was not quite clear, perhaps. If you could put that in writing so that we can do it.
Chair, you know, we were told earlier that one of our problems in the motor industry is that the market is too small constantly. And it seems to me that if all the municipalities had submitted one procurement, one tender to some one company, we would have a wonderful domestic industry. And you know, there's a lesson here for us and for our report. You know, the role of the state is crucial in coordinating the economy, you know, and you almost feel, let's go to a command economy because that would have happened, or a planning commission which decides these matters. But here is an example where each municipality is battling on its own with 40 vehicles here and 50 vehicles there, and our industry is saying the market is too small. Well, it's actually quite a big market if they work together. And I think we should say something about that in the report.
Yes, there was a question, a specific question raised though by Honourable Kotsi. Did you hear that? But you may answer it in writing.
Related to the number of sustainable jobs?
Yes, do you want to do it in writing?
I can't give a specific answer now, but I'll have to give that to you in writing. It's going to be a difficult question to answer because what we are trying to do is to actually transform the current taxi industry. Mm-hmm. So there should be no net gain in jobs, but there should be no net loss in jobs either. So we're actually taking people out of the current taxi industry and transforming that industry into the BRT type system and utilizing the current operating staff, the current taxi operators and their staff, their drivers, and bringing them into the industry, training them as drivers, training them as service personnel, training them to assist where possible if they're not successful as drivers, but they can help out at security at stations and such like. So we have a whole program in place to try and transform that whole industry. So there will probably be no net increase in jobs, but we hopefully will create a more sustainable transport system and a more affordable transport system, which will have some knock-on benefits. I don't know if that answers the question, but
I think to some degree it does. But if you do have anything once you get back to the office and can consult colleagues and so on, it could also be useful if you could flesh it out just a little bit in writing. I think that's really what Honourable Kotsi would appreciate. It puzzles me, some of the things that I've heard in the last few days, perhaps again today it both drew my attention to the metros. It seems that we don't actually build our own chassis in this country. We seem to be, you know, I have a Morris Minor, so I can deal with the Morris Minor situation. But I'm thinking now of the chassis. We surely, that sort of technology and the materials can't be so sophisticated that we're unable to do, you know, produce or manufacture whatever ourselves. I suppose it would be some sort of involvement of the steel industry, and, you know, I don't know too much about this, but surely we can't just keep on, and I'm looking at DTI as well, the Deputy Director General. We need to perhaps bring some players to the table to just find out how feasible this is, what is actually involved. It would be useful, I think, for the committee to learn from DTI, who may be able to access this a lot easier than ourselves. What is involved in the production of a chassis, our own chassis? And from little that I know, a lot of cars use the same kind of chassis. A lot of trucks use the same kind of chassis, and so on and so forth. So there's something that could be compatible with a variety of vehicles. So it wasn't specifically directed at the Cape Town Metro, but just a comment here. The other thing is on the procurement, specifically in relation to metros and local government generally, there was a time, I believe, when procurement was done by elected representatives rather than perhaps another form of panel. Now, as far as I can understand, the Municipal Management Finance Act may have dealt with that. But it may be useful just to find out about that, but also from both the metros, what measures are in place to ensure, as far as possible, free and fair procurement? You know, we realize that there'll always be something and someone that slips through. We know that. But what measures are in place to develop a more robust procurement system? And if possible, to increase the local content, even if this, we've been told at national level, we should actually negotiate how much of a local content and this, that, and the next thing is provided, and not trying to start begging for it once these deals are signed or contracts are entered into. So it may be something worth looking into. But specifically to address the Cape Town Metro, I know you have made a lot of reference to the 2010 and the short time available and so on to be able to tender and then finally procure these buses. So I'm not sure, perhaps it should be a lesson to government in general that when we are planning these huge events, to look at some of the capital and infrastructure that would be required and to factor in much longer lead time to enable us once again to source such products locally. But I think even as a metro, you should, I would hope, in these interprovincial and intergovernmental meetings, refer to that so that we don't repeat these mistakes ad nauseum in the country. But I want to thank you really for being with us here at short notice yourself, and if you would just kindly put anything else in writing to us, it would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
We now, just before I'm left without any members, I don't know, my imagination, the other one, sure I can still with us.
We like flies. It's a lot more relaxing than reading. And it's Mr. Edwin Richkin. Thank you very much. Let me talk while you're setting up then, Mr. Rindiken. You know, with respect to the Department of Public Enterprises, obviously the department is directly accountable on most of its issues, if not all of them, in a sense, to the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises. However, when there are cross-cutting issues, and in this instance, once again, it's the transport issue that we're looking at in respect of the passenger, what do they call it, passenger and freight, or whatever, the coaches, you know, measures you may have been able to implement to address this issue of local industry support and so on and so forth. The other area, of course, and we may also approach you in writing if this can't be addressed immediately. Of course, we became aware that there are two kinds of procurement system and operation. Perhaps they're not entirely different. The framework, but we understand, of course, you've got the public preferential procurement falling directly under Treasury, and then we do have a procurement framework, if you like, and program that falls directly under perhaps public enterprises involving the state-owned enterprises and that kind of thing. So what we're looking at here is a kind of broad, generic approach in this procurement, also in through the state-owned enterprises. Does the department itself stipulate more clearly a percentage of local content and that kind of thing? So I wonder if you would begin to address that. Yes, I see you have got a few slides.
Yes. So the presentation is broader than transport, if that's acceptable. What it's going to do is it's going to look at our approach to leveraging procurement. I think before starting, though, the first point that I'd like to make is really, particularly over the last 6 to 8 months, pretty much everything we've been doing in a very close partnership with the DDI. So a lot of the initiatives that I'm going to be talking about are pretty much joint initiatives. Although they're focused on public enterprises. So for example, when I talk about the policy framework for procurement that we're developing, a detailed policy framework, someone from the DDI sits in on that process and such like. So I just think that should be noted. I think the first slide is really a framework, a reasonably simple framework that we use to guide procurement leverage. So let me try and explain it to you quickly. What this slide is basically arguing is that your ability to leverage procurement is linked to the complexity of the capability required to produce a product. So if it's a relatively shallow capability, industrial capability, that industry can already produce, there isn't an enormous amount that you have to do to leverage procurement to procure nationally. That's this level here. However, As some of the members were saying, proper planning and communication can be the difference between buying the stuff locally and importing it. So some of the structural steel that was imported for the stadiums was completely unnecessary, but because of planning. Now, I do also want to make a point that very, very often it's because of unnecessary time constraints. Sometimes the time constraints are... But we've got to look at the origins of who imposes those time constraints and what their motivations are. Very often, unnecessary imports are because of the imposition of unnecessary time constraints. Then you've got intermediate industrial capabilities, which is the ability to manufacture to more or less complex specifications. And here, industry gave us a very clear signal that they will invest to
deliver on these requirements, but they need a clear medium-term procurement commitment. In other words, if we're going to buy this year from them and then put it out to tender next year and maybe buy from China for the following year, etc., they're wanting to say to invest in these capabilities, they want to have a different kind of relationship with the procurer. The next level of industrial capability is what we're calling advanced, which is really the point where engineering / design capabilities in manufacturing meet. And there, the kind of feedback from the private sector, and particularly the global original equipment manufacturers, they say when these areas are commercially viable, they still would look for government investments through organizations like the IDC in France, but they'd be looking for specialized investments or specialized supports for skills and technologies before they'd undertake this kind of investment. And I can give detailed case studies of this if people want clarification later. And then finally, globally leading, this is things like the PBMR, things you do for SATL, things you do for strategic economic purposes. The private sector won't engage with them in the short term. So based on that, analysis, we established the Competitive Supply Development Program in the DPE. And that was a program specifically to leverage their procurement to promote investments in their supply chains. And what we wanted them to do is to take full responsibility for the outcome of what they said that they would achieve. So the objective is to develop a procurement toolkit and supporting measures to promote investment and the development of internationally competitive capabilities in supplier sectors to the state and enterprises. And I think the key point being that procurement planning and execution is the key mechanism through which governments and state-owned enterprise expenditure translates into an attractive investment environment. Now, just to translate this to you into something a bit more concrete. So the fundamental requirement of the Competitive Supply Development Program is that the state-owned enterprises produce a plan, a strategic plan over 5 years saying what they're going to achieve. And this is an extract from the Eskom strategic plan. And it's based on fairly comprehensive research. So you can see at the shallow capability level, they already tend to procure overwhelmingly their requirements locally, 90% of them locally. However, at this intermediate capability level, which is the level which is entirely within the procuring organization's control, provided that there's proper planning and a proper commitment is put in place, at the start of the program, 16% of the requirements is procured in South Africa. Now, this ain't difficult industrial stuff. But because of 20 years or 25 years of limited investment, you know, these capabilities have died or gone away, and to get that reinvestment is going to require a different way of procuring. So as you can see, in Eskom's supply development plan, what they're hoping is to increase the amount of intermediate capabilities procured in South Africa to 60%. And then advanced, which is not really their responsibility, because advanced is going to require some support from government to take place. So you can't hold management accountable for the development of advanced capabilities. But there is some improvement there. And of course, in globally leading, it remains marginal. So just to give you some sense of the progress made in the implementation of Eskom CSDP, 2,000 artisans and 125 specialists being trained associated with Madupi in particular and Kasile, over R1 billion invested in local equipment and manufacturing capacity. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, the bulk of this investment is in structural steel. So, and getting that R1 billion investment in structural steel wasn't easy. It required all kinds of negotiations between Eskom and the OEMs and the industry associations and national suppliers. And that's just in shallow capability. So I'm not going to pretend to you that we've made significant progress in the intermediate space. But there has at least been progress to ensure that at least the shallow stuff is produced in South Africa. You've got 20,000 people directly employed in the construction, and I think in terms of the kind of specific industrial intervention, there's something called component hubs. I don't know if anyone remembers the standing committees from the previous regime. So for example, in something like switchgear, they had a standing committee which was made up of the universities, the buyers, Eskom, and Transnet was part of it, and the key suppliers. And they used to develop a plan to take that industrial capability to the next level over the next 2 to 3 years, submit the plan to DTI, and that would be funded. So the plan would include things like bursaries, technology development projects, investments in plant. So what it is, it's got the advantage of being very focused, but it enables that coordination. So Eskom has established hubs in transformers and motors, boiler plants and turbine plants. Transnet has made some significant progress in leveraging, so they've submitted their plan. Massive procurement skills and capability development program implemented. I think there are over 500 people now enrolled in this capability development program with the Chartered Institute of Procurement. However, I want to, if you cannot quote me on these numbers, but if I can give you something indicative, I mean, we put about 120 people through a really fast-track procurement skills program. To the best of my knowledge, so I'm giving you personal knowledge, is less than 10 remain. So they've been poached, they've left, you know, everyone knows their management issues in Transnet, but it gives you a sense of the demand for these people in general industry. Transnet has established the Rail and Harbour Supplier Association to facilitate communication and benchmarking, and I'll talk more about that. The top 20 tier one suppliers, so 20 tier one suppliers have been benchmarked. In terms of the recent locomotive procurement, which was 100 diesel locomotives, what was interesting there is, again, initially the procurement had to be done very urgently. Then the global recession came and we had extra time. In that extra time, we got significant improvements in local value add and a significant drop in price. I can't give numbers publicly. For the technology transfer that they got with the procurement, that's worth about 414 million. The manufacturing, that's the locomotive related. The manufacturing related, this is Six Sigma quality control programs, is 18 million. 52 million investment leveraged in manufacture and 108 million invested in leasing, which is a financial services company. Training and rail maintenance worth 45 million in the supply chain, in other words, their suppliers 37 million, and guaranteed exports, a kind of offset associated of 385 million. So this, you know, the department was focused on what could be achieved at an enterprise level, and that meant focusing on the intermediate. Now we want to work at the strategic level to go for advanced, and this is where this core partnership between DPE and DPI becomes so critical, because it's going to involve this coordinated effort. So at the moment we're piloting the fleet procurement approach, or programmatic procurement approach, with locomotives. So we've got a task team in place. We've had a number of meetings. I'm meeting a whole bunch of OEMs next week. The big challenge is going to be on funding. Now, I just would like to mention to members this issue of funding locomotives. So, rail transport is associated with a range of positive externalities. It makes the roads less congested, it makes the roads safer, it's a lower price per ton kilometre for the goods moved, and of course, the hot issue of the day, there's much lower, significantly lower carbon emissions. However, unless the system gets specifically subsidized, those externalities go unfinanced. You get enterprise level investment. An enterprise level investment decision will not capture those externalities. There's a strong case to be made that government does support this kind of fleet procurement. So the locomotive, the age of the fleet is 32 years old on average. It contributes, that age means a hell of a lot of time spent in maintenance and not very reliable. My sense is we need to have a yearly, fairly significant number of procurement. I unfortunately haven't got a mandate to give the number, just to maintain it at 32 years old. An annual procurement just to maintain it at 32 years. What we need to do is, number one, expand capacity, to expand our Oryx and Coallink and container capacity, as well as bring down the age of that fleet. That means that there will be significant long-term demand for locomotives. We're also exploring quite aggressive fleet procurements for renewables, concentrated solar power and air transport. The final thing I just want to bring to your attention is over this coming year we're going to be designing a complex capital procurement training program, because number one, you can save an enormous amount of money for the country by procuring your capital goods efficiently. So for example, to give you insight into this, China has an institute that all the institute does is look at how to improve the procurement of power stations. They've got another institute how to improve the procurement of locomotives. Of course, China has got a certain scale. But that is how complex and sophisticated you can get to in these major capital procurements. And of course, when you link it to industrialization, the contracting becomes really, really interesting, and the capability is limited in South Africa. The Koreans know how to do it very, very well. The other initiatives, some additional initiatives that we've got in partnership with the BTI and UNIDO, is the development of a national industrial buy and supply database. Our objective is to have trained 20 associations in benchmarking, to get 500 suppliers benchmarked and 2,000 profiles over the next 3 years, and to develop a buyer database so suppliers can see what's coming up. And then finally, we're working on, as we speak, a comprehensive enabling policy around supplier development. Now, Transnet has actually developed, I don't think I'd be exaggerating, say almost revolutionary procurement policy that ensures that supplier development considerations are taken into account from the pre-feasibility process right through the feasibility, through the procurement, through the contract management, etc. And if they're not taken into account, then the auditors will have a problem with the procurement. Now, our objective is to take that policy one level up to a shareholder management level, as well as to develop policy for these fleet procurements or programmatic, where you're going to require 15-year partnerships with single suppliers. And the policy isn't clear on that at the moment. And BGI is part of this process of looking at aligning these empowerment codes. So that's what we're up to.
Thank you very much, Mr. Richkin, for that submission. I must say, I've learned a little bit more about the procurement on the SOE side. So, members, the floor is yours. Can I see any hands on my left, please? Right, Honourable Turok. Right, Honourable Kotze, are you still with us? Right. Thank you. Over to you.
I'd love to ask 20 questions, but it's very late. I'll just ask one. You know, some of us have been trying to track the role of DPE for some time.
Just a minute
here. Yeah. You know, have been a bit at a loss because one isn't quite clear how DPE operates with respect to all the state-owned enterprises. I've never seen a document comprehensive which sets out, you know, what you guys are trying to do. And this is the first time that one hears of some coherent attempt to at least get procurement in line. I mean, you heard my earlier question about procurement from specific municipalities. It applies to the SOEs as well. Is there any, you know, what is the overall strategy of DPE with respect to state-owned enterprises to create a certain unity of action and policy and all that? What have you been doing for 15 years?
Should I answer now?
We'll just see if there are any other questions in this regard. No. I have just a couple myself. I'm trying to just get them into my head, so do answer that one because I'm not looking at the document.
Okay, so first of all, you've got to appreciate when the post-apartheid government came in, they were going to privatise all SOE. So you had really until 2004, when Alec Irwin came in, you had a completely ambivalent relationship to these organisations where they weren't allowed to invest. Management was kind of not taken that seriously to say you were going to privatise these things. You weren't a committed owner. Since 2004, we've thought of these enterprises as instruments of industrial policy. And we've been doing a lot of work with the DTI around how we think about SOE as instruments of industrial policy, and I can send you certainly our strategic plan has got that information, and I can send you papers, lots of papers that we've written on. But the fact of the matter is, I mean the easiest way of describing, you know, the power of SOEs is, for a number of reasons, I sat in on interviews for a PA, for a friend, because for a number of reasons. Anyway, so these people are basically secretaries, and we said, why do you want to work for the DPE? And they said, well, you know, you've got oversight of Eskom, Transnet. This is a very, very powerful department. But is it being used as such? Is it being recognized as such? Are we working together? I think they can see it, but I don't think government has really woken up to how powerful state-owned enterprises can be as vehicles of industrial policy.
Yes, I'm not sure just where on the slide it was, but you were referring earlier on to 5-year, 15-year possibilities in terms of procurement. But you also added somewhere that there is a limited base right now on the number of industrialists, manufacturers who could supply some of these parts. I think the components was one of them and a few others, and you said how it was a pity that had been the case because that was relatively easy. I think it was in that shallow block or whatever to develop. My question then is, if you currently have this very small pool of manufacturers, wouldn't there also be possibly the tendency to rely on one or two, but which may also then constrain the development of others? Or are you envisaging almost a rotational kind of procurement basis where you would have this list of 4 or 5 and this would be increased regularly and you would from time to time consider other players rather than, well, we've used these for 5 years, this group, and we haven't had a problem, so let's renew the contract. That does have its own advantages, of course, as you know what this manufacturer is, you worked with them and so on. And on the other hand, this may preclude the development or entry of other players in this regard. So that was the one question or comment. The other one is a difficult one for me just to put words to, but you made a reference yourself to the alignment of empowerment codes and so on. And when I see empowerment codes and then I look at EPUB and so on, I also ask myself, how do we balance this with the need to add value and beneficiation? Have you not also got some sort of code or point system that's going to look at the value adding itself in respect of local industry? Thank you.
Well, I think that, I mean, your first question really says that this ain't easy. That there are enormous trade-offs. So, for example, you start paying price premiums. If Eskom pays price premiums, it just pushes up the cost of electricity to its customers. So, you know, the suppliers do well and the customers do badly. So, it's a complex trade-off. In terms of the specific issue that you raised about industry consolidation, the global trend. Okay, how many, 30 years ago, there was about 20 companies globally producing long-distance passenger jets. Today there are two. For those two, there are two manufacturers of the tires, there are two manufacturers of the jets, there are two manufacturers of the toilets. They have very deliberately consolidated their supply chains because those key suppliers need economies of scale and economies of learning to invest in technology development and become highly, highly efficient. So a degree of competition is good for improving productivity, but sometimes strategic relationships can drive productivity even better. The kind of strategic relationships you'll find in that Toyota engenders with its suppliers and you know, Standard in Korea. So my gut feel answer to that is we have to consolidate. Recognizing that if a supplier becomes undisciplined, we can always import. So, and my experience, both in South Africa and globally, suggests that suppliers understand. You start importing, they did. So they tend to be very, very responsive. The second question. So each procurement, this is why we're not prescribing. You know, we prescribe that the SOEs needed to develop a plan and deliver on the plan and take responsibility for it. For each procurement, the procurement officer has to apply their brains and say, okay, what can we leverage? Can we leverage skills? Can we leverage investment in plant? Can we leverage an export offset, etc., etc.? What Transnet have done is developed a toolkit and a whole lot of guidelines now that we want to elevate to DPE to make available to all of the DPE's SOEs and also to Petrosa, AXA, etc., etc. But it can't be formulated, it can't be one size fits all because there's always going to be trade-offs and it's a commercial process.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Richkin, for sharing this progress with us, particularly in the procurement areas. And of course we always welcome and we're very happy when we see other submissions and people here wishing to also comment, so do go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to comment on procurement in general, and I'm not specifically dealing with some of the strategic assets, what my colleague is talking about there, but generally, Madam Chair, what we find is that the private companies, the business, these guys train people to be salesmen. They go out, they train them, they have all these specialized training. And what do we do? And I talk as government, and I'm talking myself as government, as part of it. What do we do to train our buyers? We don't train them to be buyers. I mean, our discussion with a salesman should be one way only. It should be how do you bring prices down. It shouldn't be anything else. And really, I don't think we our guys are informed to deal with those issues. We did an exercise. If you just give me a few minutes. We did an exercise on a supplier that supplied us with PVC pipes. And in 2003 or 2004, the tender was awarded. And over this period, the price went up by 67%. Escalation and the suppliers blended on the fuel price, and because crude oil was linked to the plastic, etc., etc. So we did a full analysis on this thing, and we brought all the suppliers into a room, and we did a full. We checked the fuel prices. We checked the content of that in terms of the plastic. We checked the whole thing, and actually the prices declined. And these guys were red in the face. They couldn't explain why they pushed their price up by 67%. So what we did, we went out to tender again. The price dropped by, I think, 43%. And the thing about when you've got sole suppliers, like two major contractors, you know, is a public tender the right thing to do? Because then you're just opening yourself up for increasing prices. So I'm not talking strategic assets, I understand that, but by and large, government and local municipalities spend billions on really low-level items. You know, supply of toilet rolls. I can imagine what's the cost in the country on that. And why don't we just do a metric? Go look at one of the suppliers. The macro, and look at what they're charging. You know, you find you pay more. I really think there has to be some emphasis on how our people are trained to be buyers and to deal with procurement.
Well, I feel that way about the catering in Parliament. That we need them to be trained where the purpose, because I'm sure I can buy mine for a small family far less than what they seem to be paying. But coming back, and certainly thank you very much, Mr. Joshua, for that. And I think this is just the point here, is healthy and very constructive for us to be able to share these cases.
Can I just make one last comment? So we have established a procurement capability academy. So as I say, in Transnet you've got 500 people, in Eskom has now come on board. It's completely, completely scalable with the CIPS, the Chartered Institute of Procurement and Supply, which has been customized for South African conditions. Why we did it with CIPS is because our association had four staff, theirs has got 130. But these are the programs used by Shell, BP, and such like. So I think what needs to happen is the different agencies need to be encouraged to enhance their procurement capability. The second thing is that state-owned enterprises, because they're commercial organizations, have a hell of a lot more flexibility on their procurement than what goes on in government. You kill that flexibility, and you'll kill the supplier development.
You know, I think that certainly we're going to begin to really grapple and look at all the sides to this, but it was really, it's of great value to learn that there is such a school or training institute that has been developed in this regard. It may go some way to not only reducing certain supply chain costs, but also guarding against some of the corruption that may have crept in to this particular area. But do feel free to add in writing to any of this something you may have thought of or, been inspired by other presentations or submissions, rather, and do send them along to Mr. Hermans, who has been keeping in touch with you. To everyone present here, the DTI, Department of Transport, Metro of Cape Town, Metro of Itekweni, is it? Yes, I was about to say KwaZulu-Natal, so I remember that was the province. I was born there, incidentally, so I shouldn't get it mixed up. And then also to Mr. Richkin from Public Enterprises, and our own membership and the Parliamentary Liaison Officer from DTI. Thank you. I know it's late and it's Friday. I would appeal to you to drive very slowly and safely home. Is it Thursday? Well, it felt like a Friday. Thank you very much. See you on Tuesday. Is it Wednesday? Yes, we won't meet on Tuesday, but Wednesday. Wednesday, please. And it's a very long day. Just one last thing, Mr. Richkin, I know you're anxious to just chat to your colleagues, but can we please have a copy of that PowerPoint?